Welcome to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the podcast where we uncover the secrets of CEOs, entrepreneurs, and visionaries who've used public speaking to skyrocket their businesses and their bottom line. Get ready for captivating stories, valuable insights, and practical wisdom from the trailblazers who've mastered the art of the stage. I'm your host, Kelly O'Hara, and I'm thrilled to bring you their experiences and expertise directly to you. Let's get started. Let's be honest. Some stories are too wild for fiction, and others, they're the kind of comeback tales that hit you right in the gut, then light a fire under you. This is the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, and I'm Kelly O'Hara, and today's guest didn't just beat the odds, he flipped the entire game on its head. We're talking about what happens when you take a former felon, you give him a shot, and he turns that into a $12.5 million empire. Not in theory, not in 10 years, but in real time with receipts. If you think this is just another story about sales or success, well, buckle up because it's not. This is about reinvention, about using your voice to shift mindsets and turning pain into profit with brutal honesty and zero fluff. Luke Lunkenheimer is not your typical sales guru. In fact, he's the anti-guru. His journey starts with a football injury and ends with owning three car dealerships, founding one of the most effective sales team systems in the country, and helping over 30 former inmates launch legitimate businesses. And yes, there's a prison stint in the middle of that timeline. But what makes Luke dangerous in the best possible way is that he teaches persuasion with soul. He's the founder of Paid to Persuade, a sales training program that ditches the robotic scripts and teaches you how to close with confidence, clarity, and authenticity. His mantra, authenticity sells. One more time, authenticity sells. Confidence closes. And the results back it up. Luke has spoken to thousands, including 5,000 entrepreneurs at the National Achievers Congress. But the ripple effect of his voice goes way deeper than stages. It's changing lives. It's unlocking income, and it's redefining leadership after adversity. Luke, I just want to welcome you to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight. So let's get into it.
Thank you very much. That was quite a warm welcome. I'll have to de-swell my head to fit on the screen here.
You are a non-traditional guy that deserves a non-traditional intro. I'm excited to have this conversation today. And, you know, you didn't take the traditional route to success, not by a long shot. I am expectedly intrigued with the idea of bank robber. You really, if that's what we're going to talk about, we always talk about journey and the importance of the steps that leads you to the expertise that you bring that makes a difference in other people's lives. But bank robber, that's a really interesting path. You got to share how that all came down.
I would love to tell you that it was a premeditated plan, like a scene out of an action thriller movie, and that I had planned it for weeks and had a team together and executed with AK-47s, cargo vans, and nun masks like Ben Affleck in The Town, but it's not that quite that glorious. I suffered with a bad opiate addiction for many years. My family was, there was a history of addiction in my family, alcoholism, drug addiction, and you don't realize being a young guy from a small town and not having a lot of access to resources and education, when you're not properly educated about these things, the pitfalls can be right in front of you and you can be none the wiser. I had no idea of the heredity or how genetically predisposed, rather, that I was to addictive behavior until I discovered at a young age alcohol and drugs. And in the town I grew up in, it was a small town, it was a rural town, a lot of farm kids, and having field parties and knocking back a few beers after hay season or going and milking the cows and going out and partying. This was just normal modus operandi. It wasn't, you talk to most people and tell them there's a group of 12-year-olds out back doing keg stands and drinking and line dancing, they would tell you that's not good at 12 years old. Where we grew up in Cato, New York, if you weren't cracking a beer by 11 or 12 years old, then you weren't having any fun. So that led down a road of kind of normalizing partying. The substances were just what you did to have fun and break away from the stress of the week. So really what brought me to the point of bank robbery was being in such a small town, there were only a few ways out. You could do incredibly well on your SATs and get a scholarship to an Ivy League school. I was a smart guy, but I wasn't quite that smart. So that wasn't an option for me. There were rich parents that would pay for college for you. And again, I didn't have that either. So for me, the only other conduit to get out of this small town and experience any kind of success was through athletics. And I was a tall guy. I was a fast guy. I could jump high, run fast. And I was your typical farm-bred country boy that just was real strong and underdeveloped at the time. So as I grew into my manhood, I just continued to get faster and stronger. And to be candid, I wasn't like a Division I athlete type, but I was certainly worthy of a scholarship to a Division II school because of my academics. So that's what I landed. And my plan, it was beautiful. My senior year, I discovered that I had landed this scholarship. I got accepted to the college. Everything was great. This was my way out. In one of the later games of the senior season, because we were a small school, we played both sides of the ball, and I was injured very badly on defense, and the scholarship was as quarterback. So I lost my throwing arm. My right side got destroyed. I dislocated my shoulder, and ultimately, it's like bending the axle on your best race car. You just never come back from it. You can replace parts, but it's just never going to be that slick machine that it once was. So unfortunately, now I'm met with, I had a plan. I don't have a backup plan. What do I do? So I got into the car business, and that's where my sales tale begins. I'm a salesperson by trade. And fast forward probably a decade later, that's how we get to the bank robbery. And that decade consisted of dabbling in recreational drugs and alcohol to getting a surgery to try to fix the shoulder, the surgery not going well, the combination of not getting back the throwing arm that I once had, plus the depression of knowing that I was never going to play football again, plus the fact that I was at 22 years old going on past my prime now, my best years are behind me, not realizing the naivete and that I was only just getting started, became very fond of these little pills that they would give me that were supposed to help with my shoulder pain. I noticed very quickly that they also helped quite a bit with my emotional pain. I'd take one of these pills and the shoulder would feel pretty loose and I could play a game of basketball at the YMCA. And I would also forget about the bills that were coming due for a little while. And I would also forget about the girl that I think might have been cheating on me. And I would also forget about the fact that I got written up for being late to work that day. And it was like, man, this is great. They say that opiates induce a sense of euphoria. And I read that later on in life. And when I read that, it gave me goosebumps. It resonated so well because that's truly what somebody who has an affinity for that type of narcotic feels is truly euphoria. Everything's okay. Everything's going to be fine. The pain goes away mentally and emotionally. And you just have this energy and this acceptance that everything's going to be fine. So very easy to get addicted to that kind of substance. When you learn about opiate addiction in addicts, you understand that many people who have attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, really what it is, it's a lack of naturally occurring dopamine. The life stimulus that occurs for the average human being is pretty worthwhile. It's pretty worth living. A kiss from your wife on the way out the door, or seeing a fuzzy bunny in the pet store, these things, they release dopamine and they induce euphoria in the human mind and body. So this is the life that most people are living. The person who suffers with ADD or ADHD isn't getting that dopamine from the normal day-to-day activities. They're only getting a dopamine release from an extreme activity. If they see the rabbit attacking the other rabbit and they got to pull them apart, or if the mom gives them a kiss and then gives them a candy bar and a $50 bill to hit the arcade with after school, it takes an extreme level of stimulus to give that person the same thing that the average human being is feeling at all times. I suffer from ADD as well. So imagine you're this young kid with a bruised ego and his path has been disrupted and you're very unsure of yourself. And now, you know, you're not knowing it, but there's this lack of free dopamine occurring in your mind. So your friends and your peers who are getting and your colleagues who are living their lives and getting stimulus from the normal day-to-day stuff, you're just not getting that. You're not understanding. How can you sit on the couch and watch a football game and just be perfectly okay with sitting there? And how can you go out and mow the lawn and get satisfaction from that? If I'm not parachuting out of a plane or doing a line of cocaine, I don't feel okay. And it's very hard to come to terms with that. So what do? You use more of the substance. You numb that misunderstanding. And it's just a very twisted braid that keeps getting wrenched up in and upon itself. And eventually you get so tangled in your thoughts that it's devastating. It's depressing. You lose track of who you are, what you're trying to do. And things that once were, okay, what is my path? What do I want to accomplish? What do I want to do with my life? Become, okay, it's 6 a.m. I'm waking up because I'm itching, because I'm going through opiate withdrawals. And all right, if I just get my pills in me, I can get through 6 hours and then I'll figure out what I'm going to do in 6 hours from now. That went on for 10 years. And if you know about opiate addiction and opiate narcotics, you know that you build a tolerance to them. So what one pill used to do now takes two pills. And what two pills used to do now takes three or four. And what ingesting the pill used to do now snorting does, and so on until you get to intravenous use, which thank God I never went down that road. I could tell you confidently I would not be here today. It's a long answer to a simple question, but to ask somebody what led them to bank robbery requires more than a few words. And I've probably at this point for the listeners painted the picture to show a guy who's very lost, very devastated, chemically disrupted, and very dependent upon a narcotic. And when you're an opiate addict, if you don't have the drug for a sustained period of time, you become very ill, very depressed. Your dopamine, your serotonin levels all fall through the floor. Norepinephrine release doesn't happen. You get very physically achy and in pain, and just it's a very difficult state of being. So the mind then goes to whatever I must do to return to my state of normalcy is what must be done. So you take a guy who's lost his job and lost his on the outs with his girlfriend and rent is 2 months behind and everything is looking bleak. You give him his girlfriend's car to use for the day and a half a tank of gas, and he feels that he's within 2 or 3 days of either suicide or not really sure what else, because nothing else really seems to make sense at that point. And you go, you know what? I always thought robbing a bank would be cool. You know what happens? I go in there, I get some money, and I'll just take off to California, leave the car for the girlfriend, and just go start over. I'll get real high on the way out there. I'll buy a plane ticket. And then, yeah, I heard there's this real good Malibu in, or rehab in Malibu called Passages Malibu. I've seen it on TV. I think I'll just go there. That's what I'll do. And you come up with this cockamamie idea of this action plan that you're going to do when you get a hold of this money. But what's going on is your subconscious mind is going, you can't get past this on your own. You need intervention of some sort. The only way you're going to get past this is if somebody probably locks you in a cage and you sweat this out for weeks and weeks, and then you're not let out of that cage for months and months to follow until finally you return to some state of physical normalcy. That's, I can tell you later, much after the fact, that's what my subconscious mind was doing. And reflecting on it, I can say to myself that I think maybe even my conscious mind knew that as well. But on the surface, it was get the money, get out of town. And underneath the surface, it was some sort of intervention outside myself must occur. I've never had, the thing was, to be perfectly frank with you, Kelly, I'm such a good salesperson. I don't say that out of braggadocio. I say that to give context to the point. Such a good salesperson and manipulator at that point in my life. Nobody could tell me I had a problem because I'd always talk myself out of the conversation. And anybody that would try to push back on me would be very quickly manipulated into some sort of condescending remark or feeling that they were wrong in some way. So people just stop trying and you become this guy on this island all alone, self-inflicted, of course. But when you get that alone and there's no strings left to tug on and nobody in the contact list answers the phone when you call and the girlfriend doesn't even look you in the eyes anymore, there's not really much else that can go wrong here. Prison doesn't seem like it would be that bad. At least it would be 3 square meals a day, a place to sleep, a room to call my own, and some sort of pattern. And that's when you get to the point where you can consciously push the metal bar on a door, walk into a financial establishment and hold it up. And that is what led to the bank robbery.
Fascinating to me that I hear you. I can hear there was a lot of pain in all of this, especially when you're trying to keep all the balls in the air. And I have to say, just from a personal experience with a family member, I've watched somebody go through this. It's interesting that you pointed out there's another voice. It's the voice inside. I think it's the voice inside that says, you need to take this to the next level. If you're going to take this to the next level, you'll be sitting down for a while. Have you ever noticed when you're overwhelmed and stressed out, things are going bad, that suddenly you'll get sick? And it's almost as if the body says, you know what, you're way in over your head here and you won't stop, you won't slow down. So we're going to help you. The kind of that other side of yourself says you need something big to make a big shift. And
I think just to augment what you said, I think you can look at it multiple ways. And I think that what was occurring in me at the time was it was my mind, similar to the way you just framed the body getting sick and letting your mind know that you've had enough. For me, it was my brain. My brain was at capacity. Every day was filled with how do I get money to get drugs, to get physically okay, to try to make progress. And by the end of each day, such an effort was put forward and so much time was spent on getting the money committing the crime, the larceny, whatever it was, or the hustle to get the money, to then finally talk the dealer who was running out of his supply at that point in the day to give me his last few ducats, just whatever you got left, man, I'll overpay for it. And it just, it became such a vicious cycle, such a hopeless cycle, that by the end of, at the end of a certain period of time, you just realize that you can't keep doing that. That can't sustain. And at that point, my mind did intervene, and it was like, listen, we're going to bookmark this page. We're going to move to a different chapter real quick and try something else out, because I'm just not going to continue living in this Groundhog Day, Bill Murray, just continual cycle of lunacy. And so very much to your point.
When did the realization happen? When did it happen for you when they shut the gates, when they shut the bars, and you realize, wow, I'm stuck here for whatever period of time that you ended up being stuck? What was that experience for you inside? Was that, did the transformation happen right away, or did it take a while? Because that's a lot to take on. That's a lot, being in prison. I know some people who've been in prison, worked with them, and it's a whole different game plan. You think you know what's going to happen, but you don't.
Yeah, there's a lot there to unpack, but to answer the simple question that was posed, when was the realization? There were several that occurred at different stages and at different levels, but the first major kind of O-S-H-I-T moment was, it wasn't when the five undercovers rolled up on the lawn behind us coming back from the laundromat. It wasn't in the car on the way to the criminal investigation division. It wasn't in the room with the one-way glass and the metal table with the cold cup of water and the pack of cigarettes. It wasn't all the movie stuff that you think. Those things, honestly, to me, were, I was waiting for them. They were coming. I knew this. There was just this kind of looming, ominous doom that followed me around, and I knew there's no way I got away with this, even though it took them the better part of a week to track me down. And I'd almost at that point convinced myself that I was scot-free. But just something, there's always been this overriding knowledge, this just gut instinct of what is to come. It's always been that way for me. I think everybody has it in their own way, but for me, it's been very pronounced, to where someone could tell me, Luke, you got away with it. They closed the case. I've got a buddy down at the detective's office. They're done with you. It's never going to be brought back up. And I would still say, no, there's something coming, regardless of what you told me. But that moment of realization was when I was in the criminal investigation division interrogation room. You know, this is the one-way glass with the camera behind the convex mirror and stuff. And the guy was going back and forth with me. We know what you did, this, that. And of course, I was playing dumb. Buddy, I don't know what you're talking about. If you want answers, at least tell me why I'm here. Oh, don't play dumb with me, blah, blah, blah. And I just remember kind of this trademark line. The guy says, Luke, listen, you're 6 feet plus, you're a muscular build, you're driving a light-colored Ford Taurus missing a hubcap. That's the description of the guy that robbed North Seneca Federal Savings and Loan, and that's who we're sitting in front of. And I said, Detective, you might want to arrest your whole precinct then. And he goes, why is that? I said, well, at least the people that rolled up on my lawn just now and arrested me. He goes, oh, yeah, why? I said, because you are all over 6 feet. You are all athletically built. You are all male, and you brought me here in a light-colored Ford Taurus missing two hubcaps. And he goes, I said, am I under arrest or am I just being detained for questioning? He goes, you're being detained for questioning. I said, then I want an attorney or I want to go. Why would you need an attorney if you're not guilty? I said, don't play that game with me, buddy. I have rights. I want to exercise them, but I would like to leave at this point. And it's on record, and this is being recorded, and there's freedom of information filings that can be done. I'll get this video. I want to go right now. And he just immediately got very nervous. And he gets up and he walks out of the room, and you can hear him talking and some mumbling and grumbling. And then he comes back and he goes, all right, Lucas. And that's always when you know you're talking to an authority figure, because nobody in the world calls me Lucas. I'm Luke. So when somebody calls me Lucas, I'm either in trouble or getting an award and they don't know me. So I walk out there, and as I'm walking to the door, he goes, all right, Lucas, you got us. You got us. I'm just letting you know, you're going to be seeing more of us. This isn't over with. I said, okay, buddy, whatever. Let me out of here. As I walk out, he's standing in between me and the doorway so I can't get out, like almost trying to get me to push. He was trying to get me to do something to give him a reason to put me in handcuffs. And I said, bro, there's a camera there. I'm not going to do anything stupid. Just get out of the way. Let me out of here. So he starts to move, and he's watching his sergeant the whole time. His sergeant's at the other end of the hallway on a phone, and he's, what do you think? What do you think? What do you? And I can hear you. What do you think? We there? Are we there? Are we there? And I'm coming to the realization that they're interrogating my girlfriend. They're creating some statement. And the moment she signs the statement, they're going to place me under arrest. So I start running down the hallway. And then next thing you know, She signed it, grab it. I'm like, damn it. And in that moment was a very mini realization. They cuffed me. At this point, I'm still like pondering the escape routes and thinking I can manipulate myself out of this. It's a very weak case they have against me. I'll probably be out of here by nighttime. And then they put me in this holding tank, and the guy walks in and he goes, 7 to 14. I said, what's that? He goes, that's what the DA is going to hit you with. 7 to 14. I hope it was worth it, buddy. And I'm like, worth what? And then he just looked me in my eyes and he goes, brother, we saw you in there. We saw your face. We saw the sweatsuit. They've recovered the bag with the money at your house. They've recovered the bandana. They've recovered the sunglasses, the Timberlands, the sweatsuit. He goes, your dumb ASS should have burned it. But that's what junkies like you do. You make stupid mistakes. And I wanted to get up and swing on the guy, but here I am chained to a bench behind bars. That was realization number one. When it had been a long time since somebody spoke to me like that and didn't catch me on the chin. And in that moment, I was like, wow, this is really happening. And I, you know, it was freshly painted black bars and just the keys on the hip of the guy. And it just brought me back to other moments that I had been incarcerated. And I was just like, man, it's real. I'm going to big boy jail this time. This isn't a county jail offense. This is a felony. I'm going to prison. So that was the big realization, to answer your question.
Wow, that is one heck of a story. And I can feel that. I can absolutely feel that. So now you realize, is that what you got? 7 to 14?
No, actually, because luckily I at the time was broke. So I had received a court appointed attorney, but she, to her credit, she was a good woman. She was a good attorney. And as much as she probably wanted to see me rot in a jail cell, she knew that it was lousy police work that had put me behind bars. And we went back and forth a few times. She goes, there, 7 to 14 is what they could sentence you with. That's the maximum. She goes, but they're offering 3.5 to 7. You take a plea of 3.5 to 7 and they will, you can plead to it and you go start serving your sentence. You'll be out by such and such a time. And I said, I don't believe they have a very strong case on me. In fact, they can't. And she goes, why? I said, we have privilege, right? She goes, yeah. I said, I did rob the bank. I said, but there's no way that they know that definitively. The only thing they have is circumstantial evidence, is potentials. There's nobody that has identified me in that bank. Because, Kelly, I hadn't told a soul. Nobody knew I robbed that bank. Nobody. Not my girlfriend, not my best friend, not my father. I didn't even write it on the inside of a bathroom wall somewhere. No, I had not spoken or uttered those words to anybody. And she goes, okay. I said, have you seen a discovery? She goes, I've seen some of it. I said, well, they don't have anything. What do they have? You're my lawyer. What do they have? She goes, they don't have much. They've got your girlfriend's statement that says what? I had some extra money and I bought the kids a laptop and boots. Yes, actually that. And they also have an informant that says that they know you robbed the bank. I said, oh, I said, let me guess. Is it the landlord from the house? Yes. I had heard some mutterings that the landlord of the house that we stayed in had a boyfriend who was a sheriff. And she thought she saw me leave the house dressed in the getup. And she started to get suspicious. She was eventually, we learned she was the snitch, if you will, that kind of turned me in or got them hot on my scent. And the funny part about it is when I came back from the bank robbery, I paid her 2 months back rent with a dirty bank money. So it would have been very easy for my attorney to discredit her and say, oh, so it was bank robbery money? Then you want to go ahead and give that back because you spent about $7,200 of it, didn't you? And so we knew that we could immediately discredit her. So now we're down to the stressed out girlfriend who would have cried on the witness stand because she was an emotional wreck and was coerced into signing a statement. Other than that, a few security camera videos that show a tall guy in sweatpants. So we absolutely could have beaten that case. But what ended up happening is they offered me 3.5 to 7. I said, you can go tell them where to put that. And then they made me sit for another month before they come up with their next offer. They make sure you rot a little bit and you're pacing your cell and you're getting a good feel for what jail food tastes like. And you want out, so you'll take whatever the next plea is. So then they came with the next one, it was a 2 to 4. In New York State, they give indeterminate sentences where you have a definitive amount of time that you must serve in jail or prison, and then you get post-release. This was 2 to 4. And I told the lawyer, I said, they don't have anything. There's nothing here. Reject the 2 to 4. I'm not taking it. And at that point, I had made a little home in the jail and had my little crew I was playing basketball with and didn't plan on getting out anytime soon. So I was fine with it. For me, I was in jail, you get time served. If you're sitting awaiting trial and you serve jail time, they deduct it from whatever your sentence ends up being. So my time's counting regardless. And at that point, I had thought to myself, I had created the reality that I would be able to negotiate what's called a 6-5 split, which is 6 months on felony probation and 5 years, or excuse me, 6 months in jail and then 5 years on felony probation. And I thought to myself, at this point, I had been in county jail for months. I was somewhat sobered up. I was starting to wake up in the morning and actually be able to function. So now I was getting to be a little bit of a pork chop. You know, I wanted to try to beat my case and be the guy that beat the bank robbery. So we pushed back, and then they came back with a 1-3. Which is one, or no, excuse me. There was one more in the in between, and I just rejected it and went back to my cell. But the final one was a 1-3. 1 year in state prison, 3 years felony probation. At that point, I had been in jail for, I don't know, 3 months or something like that. And a 12-month sentence, a 1 year sentence with good behavior, I believe would have been 10 months. I ultimately would have served about 6 or 7 months in jail. And she looks at me and she says, Luke, she goes, you do realize you're being offered a year for a felony bank robbery, a strong arm bank robbery. And I said, it's not a strong arm bank robbery. I didn't have a weapon. I didn't hurt anybody. Nobody got, the only people that got hurt were a bruised egos, the bank manager. But ultimately, I told her I wanted a 6-5 split. And she goes, I've already offered. I made that offer on your behalf because I know that you would have taken it because you'd get time served and you'd walk out of here today. I said, correct. That's what I'll take. She goes, they're not going to give it to you. I said, why? She goes, because I talked to the district attorney himself, and he will either take the loss or he wants a felony. He's not going to allow you to rob a bank in his state and let you plead to a misdemeanor. It'll be political suicide for him. So you're either going to walk and he's going to take it on the chin, or you're going to jail as a felon. I went back that night and I did some thinking, and I had her walk me through what would transpire if we took it to trial, because I was going to take it to trial and try to beat the case completely. And that's when some healing started to happen within me, and I started becoming not so concerned with myself and a little more concerned with the universe and the people in it. And I started to think about how my actions had affected other people. And I started to play out what a trial would look like in my head. And all I pictured was me sitting there in an orange jumpsuit chained to a chair, family members and friends and coworkers and people who I cared about would be paraded in, berated on a witness stand, spoken to very aggressively and very condescendingly. Probably they'd get very emotional seeing me and with my hair and my beard all long and looking like some sort of castaway. And I just, at that point, it was a turning point for me where I wasn't willing to put the stress and the weight of my wrongdoings on other people anymore. And that came in the sobriety and the lucid thinking. So I went back and asked to speak with the attorney the following day. And I went back and I met with her and I said, okay, I'll take the 1-3. And that's what I pled to. So to answer your question, after a long Donald Trump-esque weave, I was offered many things and ended up pleading to 1-3, which is 1 year in prison, 3 months felony probation, of which I went to a shock incarceration correction camp and only ended up serving, I believe, 8 months of that sentence. So collectively for that sentence, I was in jail about a year, including the time in reception, but which is phenomenal for a bank robbery. So 1 year I served in prison for that charge.
It's interesting to me to hear you, just to hear you tell the story. Obviously, an excellent storyteller, obviously an excellent story on its own, but listening to you of how you stack this up for yourself, obviously a smart guy, obviously, and someone who's able to think something through and decide and then play the odds, clearly a salesperson in the making, a barn salesman who, and if, you know, the thing about doing drugs for a long period of time, if you're going to last, you've got to be a good manipulator. You've got to, and what that gets down to is good sales technique.
You're very correct.
But I'm always curious when someone does it, if they commit the crime, how do they feel if you know you're guilty? Does that play into how you move forward? In other words, like you were good at playing the system. You're good at assessing, brilliantly assessing, you know what? They don't have this. They don't have that. I can say this. All I got to do is, this is how it'll play out with the people in my life. And you're really good at that. But for you yourself, you knew you'd rob the bank. Is it more, how do you stack that up?
Meaning, how do you weigh the outcome against what your options are?
You're good at that. You're brilliant at that. But if you know you committed the crime, does that play into it at all? Or is it just look, this is the system. I've got myself in this situation. I'm going to figure out how to get out. You're smart enough to look at all the components that are in this experience. And you did that brilliantly, served not as much time as anyone else would. You were in the game. You were in the game. And so you're obviously a player. But did it ever hit you, or did it ever resonate for you? Yeah, I actually did commit this crime.
Absolutely.
It wasn't a good thing to do.
No, I can tell you this. I can tell you that that pushback or that arrogance comes from exactly that, narcissism and arrogance, right? So you have all this time to yourself in the jail cell, and you start to kindle this flame against the world, right? You're in this jail cell, and the world did me wrong. My parents were verbally abusive, and they were drug addicts, and there was some other touchy-feely stuff in there as well. And I've been dealt a terrible hand, and mom left and my sister took off and they hit my puppy and they took my whoobie and all these. I'm obviously being facetious, but I'm saying it sarcastically because that's what it evolves into. If you're any kind of a man or an adult, is you realize that there's kids hopping around on one leg in Somalia because some sort of rebel came through and cut their leg off because they kicked a soccer ball the wrong way. And I'm over here bitching about the fact that I'm in a jail cell for doing drugs and robbing a bank. Like, story kind of tells itself. It's not like I'm a victim of circumstance. But the outset, it was more like, screw the world. The world's been terrible to me. I'll screw the system. I'll manipulate my way through this. And once again, I'll be the victor who got away unscathed. And then you go back to your cell and you're listening to the people up all night and you can't sleep and the guards whacking the bars with his stick and all these things. And you're like, man, you know what? Who the hell am I? Why am I even pushing back? I did this. I walked into a bank. I scared the living bejesus out of some poor old ladies and probably scarred them for life. And maybe one of them could have a heart problem now because of the amount of cortisol that was released at that moment for them. And I'm sitting here trying to get away with this. I'm trying to talk my way out of it. I should be lucky that they gave me the offers that they gave me. I think it's a combination of your survival instinct and just that, you know, I'm not a risk averse person. I tolerate risk very well. I always have. I'm the guy that used to jump my BMX bike off the roof of my log cabin down the hill to see if I could do it. I'm the guy that when I first got my driver's license, the moment I got away from having a ride-along driver, I was doing 110 miles an hour down the hill to see how fast the car could go. And that's where you ADD and the adrenaline junkie and the dopamine, it all plays together, right? It's all part of a big, nasty, evil circle. But so I think it's that daring part of my personality that was like, well, let me see what I can get away with here. And it's just kind of always been that for me. Let me see how far I can push it. Let me see how much I can get away with. Let me see how much I can do and then talk my way out of. And it's just been, that was the pre-Renaissance era existence of Luke Lunkenheimer. It was just this nefarious bad actor who would do dirty, dastardly things. And to a point, I'm not the bad stuff, just the very rude stuff and punk stuff like drugs and stealing. And I just wanted to see how much I could get away with. So that the reason for the pushback was the arrogance and the attitude and the some sort of self-preservation instinct. But the fact that you're guilty, absolutely. Because when you go back to the lawyer and you say, I'm not willing to take that, I'm only going to do this. If she were to push back and say, that's stupid, I'm not even going to offer that on your behalf, you're an idiot, you did it, take the 3.5 to 7. I would have gone, all right. So it was a series of things moving in my direction. And again, once again, Kelly, being such a strong personality and nobody pushing back, it again led me to what could have been a very dark place. I could have pushed that and taken it to trial out of my own arrogance and then done 7 to 14 years. It could have ended very differently for me. But to answer your question, the fact that I was guilty, yes, it was a very surface level pushback and arrogance. And I can tell you in hindsight that had they pushed back and held me accountable a little bit more, you probably would have seen a guy that had done 3 or 4 years in prison and pled to that, because I was guilty.
It's clear to me that you have incredible entrepreneurial spirit and the fearlessness to go after what you want. And this, again, is you're on your way. Even in the story you're telling, it's such a perfect example of at some point you need to find your purpose, right? Everybody does. You hope that they do. Life isn't worth living if you don't find it. And you could have many purposes. Yours clearly was forged in fire. Sales is an absolute no-brainer for you. So when did you become like crystal clear on the why of what you were doing, and how did it reshape you and the way that you show up in the world. Because isn't that kind of magic of this story is how what did this incredibly intense chapter do that sent you in the direction that you're in today, where you are the winner?
Well, I appreciate those words, and it's a many faceted stone. And the first part of it would be a complete realignment of my moral compass, full stop, before anything else. When I said, I made the comment about the pre-Renaissance and post-Renaissance Luke Lunkenheimer, I don't say that in third person to try to sound cute or out of arrogance. I say it because it's a very real thing. I step back outside of this tale and I look down on it, and there's two very different human beings that are alive in that same 41-year span. Sometimes I'll get a little emotional talking about it, because before that chapter, the robbery and all that stuff, just between my parents and my friends, I was part of a group of friends that were bullies. Luke, go tip that retard's tray down the front of him. Make that retard suffer. I'd go over to the retarded kid and dump his tray and his milk down the front of him. And it was because I was seeking validation. When I would do that, my friends would laugh and, oh, monkey, he'll do anything. My nickname at the time. He'll do anything. Awesome, monkey. Yo, Luke, yeah, throw an apple at the girl with the Coke bottle glasses. See if you can knock her glasses off her head. And I would do it. And these were terrible things that at the time, when all your buddies are laughing at it, and even some of the male supervisory figures are like, oh, geez, Luke, there you go again. You can't do that. And really not paying any homage to how dark these acts are, you begin to normalize it. And you begin to feel like, okay, this is just what alpha males do. We beat people up. We pick on people. We drink a lot. I'd go to school with my car. There'd be a 30-pack of Coors in the back of it and a pack of Marlboro or Camel Wides, excuse me. And I would drink four or five beers and smoke a half pack of cigarettes and then go to school. That was just reality for me. So when I talk about, you ask what flipped, what changed, what moved me into that period and brought me to where I am, the very first thing was actually understanding that the first half of my life was a very bad human being, a person that I'm not proud of, that a person I had to live in that shell and be a part of that vessel to be who I am today. I couldn't be this guy without having gone down that road for many reasons. And that's a whole tale in and of itself. But people will say, geez, do you wish you could go back? And I don't, because you can only relate to certain pain if you've experienced it. And you can only help people with certain issues if you've had them. And you can only appreciate the things that you have when you've been on the other side of the fence. So I don't discount that or wish that it wasn't there. I certainly don't wish it upon anybody else. But the number one, first and foremost major shift for me was actually believing that doing the right thing had merit. And that's probably very crazy for people to hear that and be like, how could somebody possibly think that doing the right thing didn't have any merit? When you have a parent who sprays the underside of a car frame with black spray paint to hide the rust and then sells it to the little old lady down the street for twice as much as he paid it because he bought it with a bad frame but sold it with a, quote, good one, you go, oh, that's just how we make money. Dad, isn't that the wrong thing to do? Son, someone's going to get her. We better be the ones making the money off it. And you're like, okay, I can. And there was always, and again, surrounded by salespeople, there was always good logic. There was always a good reason for why we're doing the wrong thing. And when you're naive and you don't have a spine, and it's not just one or two, everybody in your world is telling you that these things are okay. I look back on mentors that I had, people that, it's what's so funny is they're all the ones that reach out to me today and say, hey, you forgot about so-and-so. What do you mean? Man, give me a job. Hook me up. Help me out. Why? Because you wouldn't be you without me. I taught you how to do this and I taught you how to do that. And so, yeah, where were you for the 10 years that I was going through it? Where were you for the 2 years, 3 years collectively that I was in jail and prison? Where were you during the rehab? Where were you when I was broke? My phone didn't ring then. You weren't telling me that you wanted to be a part of my world because you taught me everything I knew, when what you taught me how to talk the old lady out of the money on her front porch and then never deliver the product. That's what you taught me to do. Do you want to go back and help me pay that debt? Oh, you don't? Then get off the goddamn phone. So those people will surface. And it's funny when they do, it's like, you didn't teach me how to sell. You taught me how to lie. You taught me how to cheat. Steal, whatever cliche you want to use. You taught me bad stuff, bro. Again, I'm riffing here, but I can't express how important it is to my story that at some point there was a very clear shift into believing that if you just do the right thing, that things will work out. I had been taught to align monetization with malicious behavior. The better you can smack them, the worse you can get them, the deeper you can cut them, the better you get paid. Someone's going to cut them, may as well be your knife. And that's how I was born and bred. Major shift of the moral compass, Kelly, would be the first and the foremost.
I absolutely love this conversation. And I think that it's more timely now than it's ever been. And I'll tell you what's really interesting about it for me personally is, and what I hope that the audience might give this conversation a chance to, is that when we started this conversation, I didn't know Luke before we, other than my research about him, but I hadn't talked to him personally, and we could not have connected quicker. We could not have connected in a more significant way, probably. Maybe there is a better way, but I loved it. Initially, I thought, well, I'm really excited. I know that this person is going to bring something great to the table. And there are many things that we're going to talk about that really will absolutely be what we planned. But I got to tell you, right now, at a time when country's going through what it's going through, and we're watching a lot of dark behavior going on. And one of the things my husband and I talk about is that I don't spend a lot of time on garbage, TikTok, or not that TikTok's a terrible thing, but it's very distracting and it's addictive. You get caught in shorts and you get caught. And right now they're running a lot of things about courts and the people that show up in court with a crime, that they've committed horrendous crimes, but they're so rude and disrespectful to the judge. And the judge throws the book at them just for bad attitude. And you cheer. You think these people need to go away. Everybody's being really nice. I would be cruel. I have a big thing about bullies, Luke. Baby, I really have a problem with bullies. And that's a big issue to me. What I love is having the opportunity to walk through this whole experience with you online while we're talking in a conversation. And I told you before we got on that the prison population is an interesting population. Turns out it's just people. I've been working with them. I had worked with them for a while in the parole program, as they're just going to be let out soon. Mm. And they're moving their way into it. So they're still in prison. Fascinating. And so I feel that you are such a great example of, you need to give people a chance to turn it around. And sometimes it needs to get really bad for them. But they're in there, and hopefully they discover it on their own. But I love your story, and I'm so glad you were willing to tell it. I think it's powerful. I think the next section of this is going to be so exciting for people to see someone who took what are great natural tendencies and what are developed skill sets on one's choices when one is not really in the best place in life, and turned it into something that not only it turned you into a wild financial success, but that more than that, it helped other people that might have been lost along the way and on the wrong track, and you were able to help them. So let's move to that part of the conversation. I hadn't planned for it to be have the same cadence that it turned out having, but that's the magic of a great conversation.
I was going to say,
it goes never where does. It's supposed to go, right?
Yep.
I want to talk to a man that clearly is sure of himself when you're making a move. I'm telling you, true entrepreneurial spirit. And you go out and you create a business called Paid to Persuade. First of all, from a marketing standpoint, that's what I've done forever. Really? It's not just a sales program. It's really this, you know, revolution against kind of robotic, script-heavy, heavy status quo. What was the point for you that came that you said, screw scripts, there's a better way to sell, and I'm going to build a better mousetrap? What's that? How did you find that?
That's a great question. So the precursor to all of this for the audience, if they're not familiar with my tale, when I got out of prison, I went back to the normal workforce, got involved, lost a couple jobs because of my history, applied, got the job, lost the job because they looked a little deeper into my application and found out I was a felon, even though I clearly disclosed it, which I later found out was not legal of them to do, but hindsight is always 20/20. I was given an opportunity by a gentleman that I used to work with, one of these calling me later in life and, hey, what about me and what about what I did, those kind of guys, offers to have me partner with him in a used car dealership. He staked the money. He got the dealer's license. He's just not doing very well at it, and he'd like my help. So I go in there, make him a bunch of money, build his inventory, move him to a better location, start crushing it for him. Probably 11 months later, he steals $40,000 from me, which was the nest egg I had built up. So now, like, I had got some momentum. I had done some great things. I was starting to get some legs back underneath me. And imagine being a guy that was never able to save 40 bucks, having $40,000 in a bank account. I was high on life. I had life solved at that point. And that happened. And then I went back into a 9-to-5 for a guy that reached out. He was a friend of the family and a former employer, and said, listen, I see you've turned things around. He fired me at one point for theft of services. And he goes, I see you've turned things around. I know who you are. And if you're really you and back to being sober, I'd like to give you another shot at working here. And that was a mid six-figure position. So I was like, yeah, it's pretty good timing, Rich. Thanks. So I went back to work for him, started doing very well for him. He then offered to stake me to start my own car dealership. I had performed so well for him. He just came to me one night and he said, I know where you're going. You don't know where you're going yet, but I know where you're going. And once you figure out where you're going, you're not going to be here selling this product for me at 10% commission. He goes, so what I'd like to do is stake you to go where you're going. And then for the first 4 years, while you figure out where you're going, we'll split the profits. And then eventually you'll get to where you're going and I'll be able to make a little more money off you and you'll be thankful that you did. And I'm like, I was so taken aback. First, I thought he was kidding. I thought it was a cruel joke. And then the next day when I came back, I was like, were you serious about that? And he goes, I'm 1,000% serious, after I'd thought about it for 24 hours, which I didn't really need to do, but I felt it was the diligent thing to do. And when I said yes, he handed me a checkbook with $150,000 in it. That's a guy that
you got angels. You got an angel.
Wow. I've earned them. I promise you that. But yes, the opportunity came to me because of the amount of money that I had made that man. And he knew that eventually, once I smartened up and realized that all that was happening was I was going out and cultivating business and putting it in his cash register and then getting 10% of it. And that if I had left, a major chunk of his business would leave. He knew once I got wise to that, that I would try to parlay that into further benefit for myself. And I think he wanted to nip that in the bud and didn't want me to go down that path of selfishness again. So out of generosity, he did what he did. And it worked out very well for him. He made a lot of money over our four-year partnership. And after it was over, he allowed me to buy him out. And so now we're probably 5 years post-prison, and I've had these stumbles and these falls, and then I start building these car dealerships. In 2020, that was in 16. In 2020, I buy him out. Now imagine, this is 5 years outside of prison, okay? Mind you, the 5 years went by like a blink of an eye. But in 5 years outside of prison, I went from getting fired from 9-to-5 jobs for being a felon to partnering with a guy for a year to losing the $40,000 nest egg that I built to going back to a 9-to-5 job to then, over the course of 4 years, start from absolutely nothing, build a car dealership out of a little corner paved half-acre lot in Syracuse, New York, which is not a thriving metropolis, mind you, and then, as that continued, was able to convince him to scale. Let me open another one. This one's doing so well. So we did. And then right before the end of our partnership, it was, let me open another one. He goes, you open the other one. You don't have to even put that in our partnership. So when I bought him out, I bought the two stores from him and had my third. And we now had an empire of used car dealerships that were making us lots of money. And at this point, I started to learn more about business and scale and delegation and installing management. And what I learned, very simply put, and you asked me, how did I get into the sales thing and how did that realization happen? I realized after probably 6 to 7 years of owning those dealerships that my skills were not in marketing. They weren't in inventory acquisition. They weren't in being a good car dealer and polishing, putting lipstick on a used car pig. That's not what I was good at. I was decent at it, fair to Midland, if you will. But what I was really good at was taking an average Joe off the street and turning him into a vicious closer. Somebody who didn't understand people, didn't understand business, and just by giving them a framework to operate by and altering their mindset, shifting it a little bit, that I could take quite literally anybody and turn them into a six-figure earner. So That's how I continued to build my company. And again, the epiphany did not happen that I was good at sales training. It was just, I'm good at building car guys. I was asked to speak because of my tale, the redemption tale, and what I'd built in 2023. So not but 2 years ago, I was invited by the National Independent Auto Dealers Association to come speak to a very large group of car dealers. And in doing so, they wrote an article about me in Used Car Dealer magazine, and they were so moved by the article that the editor made it a cover story. So they put me on the cover of you. Mind you, I'm now 4 or 5 years into being a car dealer. I've built these car dealerships. I'm out of prison for less than a decade, and now I'm on the cover of Used Car Dealer magazine. And to the audience listening, I just want to footnote this here. I'm nobody special. There were 87 kids in my graduating class. My mom took off. My dad was a good guy with a good heart, but made some very bad decisions. I did not have any trampoline to bounce off of. I'm just a guy, okay? A guy that up until just a few years ago was happy going to work at a 9-to-5 job, making 150 grand a year, which anybody I don't think would mind making six figures, but it was off of a lot of hard sales work. So it's not like it came easy. But my point is, I'm the guy that you would go into the car dealership and buy a car from. Just a guy. But because my work ethic was so tenacious and what I did was so financially advantageous for the guy that I worked for, I say success like success. This guy just saw a guy that was tenacious and was going to make whatever work that he touched and was like, you know what? I know he's got an affinity for cars. Let me stake him in doing that. So what I'm saying to the audience is you'd be amazed if you just do your thing. Just put your nose to the grindstone and give absolutely everything you have. And the thing is, I don't think most people understand what absolutely everything they have is. I don't think most people understand what their potential is. I don't think they understand that their mind will only allow their body to do 80% of what it's capable of. And when they learn to unlock their mind and get rid of that safety mechanism that the brain puts in place, the output that you can achieve is incredible. And when the right people see that output, they can't help but throw opportunity in your direction, whether it's a job at their place, whether it's a spot in their C-suite, whether like me, it's an investment to help them cultivate their talents while they make money off them. These things happen every single day. And I had no idea until it fell in my lap. So is there a dose of luck in there? I think you would have to say yes. That didn't have to happen to me. But the flip side of that coin is, I don't know a person who worked as hard as I did to get that type of attention, okay? That's not self-appreciation. That's just, it was an insane amount of input. So you asked me how I had the epiphany and decided to become a sales trainer and get rid of the scripts and the robotic selling. I went out to Las Vegas. I was on the cover of the magazine. I was signing autographs. It was a very surreal experience. I'm some used car celebrity. I was in prison years ago, and I started walking through the expo hall. And I walked to all these booths that had sales trainers because I love selling, right? That was the thrill of the clothes is like the thrill of my life. It's closing deals and weightlifting is what I replaced drug addiction with. And so it's very near and dear to me. And I just met these guys and they were just so sideways, so slippery, just such bad actors. Like I watched their YouTube videos and stuff that they put out and they would encourage lying. What if the car's not here? Well, just lie to the customer, get them here and we'll figure it out from there. Just get them through the door. And I'm like, is this the best we got? Is this the best? No wonder the auto industry has a bad rap. No wonder car salespeople are considered bad actors. No wonder sales trainers are the laughing stock of social media. Like, you guys are terrible. That's what I was feeling inside. So
you know what, Nick? It's not even just used cars. It's even buying new cars and buying high-end cars. When people say, oh, I get to go out and buy a new car. Do you know the experience I hate the most is going to buy a car? Probably it's a so. 5-hour experience. It's they want to get you in the box and don't let them out of the box until they've signed the paperwork. And mm-hmm. this is for high-end cars, Lexus. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to have that experience. And I was just in the other day seeing a new chiropractor. And you know what made it really uncomfortable? And I said, it's really funny we're talking about this, is that once she'd done the exam and the x-ray, she said, okay, now you're going to talk to this other person. And I walked into the other person and it was the car. I said, what are you selling, a car? I need 18 treatments at $2,500 and you want me to sign an agreement for this?
Yeah, sign it right now. You get a discount if you do it this way.
It was horrible. So I love it, what you're sharing. I love it that you see what the experience is and how you do it differently. You really are all about authenticity. which I think is critical these days because there seems to be little of it. Right.
There is very little of it. And that was the conclusion that I came to. Just to put a punctuation mark on the end of that sentence for your question, I left that convention feeling very bad for the car dealers and potentially just the people that wanted to be salespeople. What they had access to as far as leadership and mentorship was concerned was garbage. And one of the, right now, I would tell you on social media, is the single best known sales trainer out there. And I won't name names, but he's a very loud character with some polarizing statements that he makes. They invited me to their place in Scottsdale, Arizona to do a podcast because the sales knowledge that I shared with their guys, they were just enamored by it. And I role played with them and smoked every one of them. And it was using the same framework each. And they're like, dude, it works every time. Like, how did you do that? So they were compelled. So they invited me out there. I did a 3-hour podcast and I shared my thoughts on the frequency of authenticity and being honest in sales and not using word tracks or scripts and just free flowing conversation that was, it had merit to it. And they didn't air the podcast. They wouldn't air it. Their leader,
Oh.
their million follower, famous on stage hype man said, he goes, you just tell him, go read the 48 Laws of Power, and rule number one will tell them exactly why we're not airing this damn thing. Have you ever read Robert Greene's The 48 Laws of Power? Rule number one is never outshine the master. So he came right forward and said, you did it better than I did, so don't you dare think I'm going to platform you. And it was in that moment, and I was there as a guest, and I was excited to be there, and I felt honored to be there. And I said, F this. I called my wife. I said, I'm investing in an online platform. I'm going to put my training on there. I'm doing this. I'm scripting it. It's real. I'm going to take over this industry. It's done. Luke's here. And she did nothing other than what she always does, which is supported me with unwavering support. And that's why I love her. And that was the epiphany. That was the moment. And there's a statistic out there that customers disengage with a salesperson who's scripted or robotic at a rate of 77%. That's a 2022, post-2022 and post-COVID statistic, and it's so accurate. Yet these guys are still out there peddling their black books of questions and their scripted sales rebuttals and all this one-liner nonsense. And that I just had enough of it, and I wanted to be the purveyor of change and the evangelist of authenticity.
Well, I just love this, and I love you telling the story about whoever we don't know it is. Imagine that you run a podcast and you're afraid that you're going to bring someone on the show who will make a difference for your audience and help them get better. And you're afraid to do it. You're afraid to put them on because they might outshine you. How pathetic is that? Then that really ruins the integrity of their show, doesn't it?
It does, and it's quite pathetic, but you know what? It pushed towards a greater good for me because what that was immediate validation that I was right where I needed to be.
Yeah. And again, I want to say to the audience, one of my favorite parts about this show, one of the favorite things I love about the guests that we bring on the show is that by their willingness to tell us their story and really do it in depth, you get a chance to look at the points of contact that made the changes. Honestly, that show that just really dissed you because they wouldn't even run the episode was the impetus to make you do your own, to make you set up your own platform. So all of these things, I really do believe that everything in your life is here to serve you, even the crappy things.
I
And the
couldn't agree
worse
more.
they are, the more powerful they are, the more powerful they move the needle for you. And you've had many of those experiences, and it's why you're the gift you are to the people that you serve, the
Thank
people you
you.
share your information with. It's
I
incredible.
sincerely appreciate that. It means a lot to me. It's humbling your words. There's one caveat that I want to add to what you said about how everything happens for a reason and is all leading to something and has purpose. It absolutely is, but the only way that you can allow it in is if you continually move forward. Meaning this, when you experience a downturn or a pitfall or a problem of some sort, to sit and to dwell on that thing as the problem that it is, that's the definition of failure, okay, as far as I'm concerned. To quit and to stop because some sort of misfortune slowed you down. That to me is the definition of failure. If that is the definition of failure, then one can live a life without ever failing if they just continue to keep moving and take that downturn as a learning experience. It happened for a reason. There was a precursor that caused this thing to happen. Figure out what it is. Make sure you never do it again. And then all of a sudden, you're not this person who had this bad thing happen to them. You're this person who took a page out of the owner's manual, read it, and realized, oh, don't worry, we'll never do this thing again. We now will have a life free and clear of this bad fortune that happened here because we experienced it. What a blessing. It's all about how you view the situation.
True. And the more you focus on the failure and you let it stop you, the more you're keeping the failure in place. In fact, you're on a road, and this is just one little stop along the road, and you're moving through. And if you always look at it as if you're moving through, these things happen, you take what you need from it, you take the experience you were supposed to have with it, the lesson you're supposed to get, and move on. Don't keep it in place. It does not define you. It reveals you, and for a lot of people, it catapults them to the next great thing that's right around the corner.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think people need to understand and recognize that their life, that is their life, is a series of these experiences. So just hurry up and get to the next experience, because there's not some grand finish line at the end. You define what the finish line is, and oftentimes you don't have any say in when it's coming. So just move on to the next experience and be thankful for what you have, as far as I'm
incredible
concerned.
Incredible advice. I absolutely love that. Now I gotta ask you about something that I know is gonna be interesting to this audience, because it's interesting to me, is that one of your big talking points, one of the main things that I thought, oh, we must talk about this, is that you're great at unlocking hidden income. And it's one of the things you like to teach, is that there's many other opportunities. And I would love for you to take a turn at breaking that down for everybody. What does that mean in real terms? And where do most people leave money on the table without even realizing it?
That's a great question. Most people leave money on the table simply by virtue of the fact that they don't believe they deserve to get it. Most people have this understanding that an entrepreneur, or to be a business person, that it requires a particular skill set, a particular personality, an investment to start. There's a million ways that I could break this down, but the first thing you do ultimately is establish where you are in the pecking order, so to speak. And I don't mean that from a societal caste standpoint. I just mean you're either a wealthy person who's got some money and can parlay your wealth into a bigger victory, or you're somebody who's sitting in the middle and needs to find their place, or you're somebody maybe who's on the beginning stages of their path and has nominal money to work with and is living paycheck to paycheck. People think that these kind of three, and there's more than three, I'm just generalizing here, that this paints them into a corner of whether they can or cannot be entrepreneurial or make money or have a business or find income. And I can tell you that for somebody who is listening to this and going, I can't buy anything to sell on Amazon, I don't have any capital, I don't have any particular skill set, it's not like I'm an electrician or a plumber, so I can't open my own business, I can't sing, so it's not like I can go on America's Got Talent, like I'm screwed, and it's okay. All right, where do you live? Do you live within 10 miles of anybody else? Yes, okay, so we're off to a great start. In that 10-mile radius, is there anybody else who has more money than you? Yeah, everybody's got more money than me. We're doing way better. Okay. Can you walk, talk, and move a broom? Yes. Okay. So I bet you, because I'm one of them, that there's somebody in your neighborhood who's got a few nickels to rub together, but's very short on time. And they would love if someone they know and trust could simply come in and make it so they come home to a made bed, a clean house with a piece of meat on the counter thawing. Because their wife passed away 3 years ago, or their wife is frequently out of town, or husband or partner or whomever. There's some sort of disconnect in their life where time is needed. And if you can fill that void for them, they will compensate you monetarily. And it's very simple. There's a big internet marketer. His name's Ty Lopez. He's viewed very positively by some, very negatively by others. I think the negative is because of jealousy and misunderstanding of business. But he said something to me, and I'm only bringing him up because I want to give the appropriate credit to the person that said this to me. And we were talking on a podcast one time, and I asked him a similar question that you just asked me, because he's been able to parlay his success into some major acquisitions and things like that. And I said, you give all these recommendations on business, Ty, but what about the guy that's got nothing? He's got no capital to invest, no nest egg. And he goes, rich people have money and need time, Broke people have time and need money. It's very simple. Go do a service for somebody that saves them time and they will pay you to do it. And it's so bloody true. The service business requires zero income to get started. It requires very little marketing. And oftentimes, the personal touch of going door to door and simply meeting somebody and saying, this is who I am, this is where I live, this is what I'm doing, I'd like to offer this service to you, that's oftentimes the linchpin. Because they're like, oh, you live close by, I know where you are, I can track you, I've seen you in the neighborhood before, I know I can trust you, yes, you can dog sit for me. Furthermore, just all the opportunities for monetization that are out there, it's almost, you almost have to try to find a way to not make money. You have Uber, you have DoorDash, you have all these things that are already pre-existing, but not to mention just wherein lies your skills. What do your friends go, man, you're really good at that. You know what I mean? Like, for instance, I know a woman locally here. She's a very good singer, okay? She needed some money one time. She was in visiting, I don't know if it was her grandmother or her mother, at an old folks home. And there was a very wealthy old lady that was in that old folks home. And one day she was singing to her, whoever that was, grandmother, mother, and she just sang a beautiful song. And it was a song that she always sang for her, this person to her. And then this other person speaks up and says, that was absolutely beautiful. If I give you $100, could you sing it again? And she goes, you don't have to give me $100, but I'll sing it again. She goes, no, it was so lovely. I've got plenty of money. I'd like to give you $100. Long story short, this girl now goes once or twice a month and gets paid a couple $100 just to sing to some old folks because there's a rich lady with a trust fund or some sort of endowment. I'm not sure what it is. I don't want to mislabel it, but she's got money to give. And the fact that this young lady performed a service that she appreciated, she was willing to compensate her for that. A couple examples there and a little bit of a weave, but at the end of the day, it's almost, you have to try to not make money. There's so many ways that you can monetize in today's society, especially with this guy right here. And for those that can't see, I'm holding up an iPhone. That's your conduit to the entire world. You can reach out and touch everybody on social media. So if you have value to bring, it's only a matter of time before you're compensated for it.
1,000% agree with you. Cannot be, people, a lot of times they get stuck in a cloud. They fear everything. Listen, get out there and have a conversation. People do business with people they like. That is truth. That is the truth. And authenticity sells. And as you say, authenticity sells and confidence closes. Mm-hmm. Honestly, feel good about what you do and what you bring to the table. And time, that's the big trade-off. Money's one thing. Time is far more precious. And even with all the tools that are out there today to help you move through your businesses and set your business up, it is amazing to me. We still don't have enough time. And if you can find a way to give people that, they care more about that than anything else. In the end, that's the big trade. I don't think money's the big win. It's having more time to do what you want to do. We're all time starved. So if you can help somebody, and there are so many different ways to do it, pay attention. Pay attention to what's going on around you and see where you can serve. And you will be paid. It will come to you in one way or another. I love your message. I think it's so important. I could spend 3 hours with you. It is such a great, I hate that we are on a time frame. I hate letting you go, but I wanted to ask you a couple of things. Your legacy, what do you hope that your legacy is going to be after this incredible life that you've had? Do you ever think about it?
Absolutely. I want to make sales honorable and sexy again. I want people to feel confident about the desire to be in sales. I want people to feel confident about the people that they go buy from. I would like sales to no longer be a naughty word or an edgy profession. I would like it to be right up there with doctor, lawyer, music composer. That is the legacy that I hope to leave behind.
Oh, I'm done. I can't even, what am I going to say after that? I always have a million questions. That's the one. That's the guy. I don't like giving you up. I'm telling you right now. I hate honoring these time crunches, but it must be done. I want to thank you so much today for coming in and really bringing the heat. It's not just with your story that is so compelling and memorable. I don't think anybody will forget this interview, but you really brought a lot of unfiltered wisdom that hits deeper than any kind of sales script ever could. You're a gift to the show. I'm really grateful to have had you.
Thank you so much. It's very kind of you. It was a pleasure to be here. I don't often get the chance to just speak so candidly. Everybody's got an agenda, but you said conversational, and that's what it was, and I really appreciate that.
Perfect. It couldn't have gone You never know where it's going to go. That's the magic of it. It's a surprise for you and me. And as long as I make sure I cover the most important parts, I think this was a master class in resilience and reinvention and what it takes to persuade with purpose. And this is what you do. I love your goal of making sales honorable and sexy. I don't think there's a better goal. I think I'm so excited. I'm going to promote the heck out of you because I think that's the way to go. It really stands out. If you all want more of what Luke brings to the table, I can't imagine that you don't. And he does it in such a visceral way. Do yourself a favor and check out his website at paid2persuade.com. And that's paid and the number two, persuade.com. He's really helping real people, not robots, double their income by learning how to sell without selling out. And his program is training. It's designed to help you ditch the outdated tactics that we all despise and step into a whole new level of sales power that feels real. It sounds real. It works. And you're the kind of speaker that reminds us that voice, it's not just a tool, it's really a weapon for impact. No reference to prison meant to be disrespectful. But it is, it's really a weapon for impact. And in the right hands, it changes lives. He's done that with so many people and it resonates. This is what we're looking for, real and authentic. We don't want to be sold, we want to be invited to participate and to engage. And I think you do that exquisitely. So I'm excited. I want to have you back on the show again. I hope you'll consider coming back.
Course.
I don't even think we hit everything I wanted to hit, but hey, that clock ticking, I just hate it.
That
So
whole
thanks
time.
again, Luke, for being here. Everybody out there, if this episode sparked something with you, please share it. Please give it to someone who needs to hear it. Someone who needs to hear that all things are possible and can show you how to do it. I would love that. If you subscribe to the Spotlight, you will not miss people like this because honestly, I just continue to delight in the incredible teachers and role models that bring their hard-earned experience and their expertise to the show. I think this is completely a blessing. I feel giddy when I get off of these interviews because I've had such rich, palpable conversations with people that stay with me. I hope it's the same for you. This show is about learning how to amplify voices that move people. Luke, he's the perfect example of that. And it shows you that speaking up and standing out, it can turn your business into a movement. That's really what Luke's about. This is not cookie cutter training. This is about making a difference. And speaking is the best way to do it. And as you can see, you will remember this conversation. I know I will. So, with that said, thanks everybody for being here. Thank you again, Luke. And as always, I look forward to our next conversation. See you next time.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive once again into the remarkable stories and insights of our incredible guests. Their experiences and hard-earned, time-tested wisdom are not just meant to inspire you, but to provide you with actionable steps to take on your own path to success. Remember, you have a story to tell, and your voice has the power to transform your business and make lasting impact. And that's what it's all about. If you found value in today's episode, let us know. And I hope you'll take a moment and subscribe to the Spotlight wherever you listen to your podcasts so you never miss a thought-provoking or idea-producing conversation. I'm Kelly O'Hara, and I can't wait to see you back here for the next episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight.